Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etric and Arisia and Woozy Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of the Who's Who podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and with me today is my flexographic co-host, Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing oh, all right, Jack. There, that's my audio approximation of the flexographic printing process.
10 years that joke's never come up. How is that possible? Folks, this is a really, really special episode of Who's Who because we are joined by one of the architects of the entire Who's Who series, Mr. Bob Greenberger himself.
Yeah, if you picked up a DC comic in the 1980s, you were familiar with Bob Greenberger's name. He worked as an editor and a writer, and during that time, he racked up hundreds of credits on series like Star Trek, Secret Origins, Doom Patrol, The Shag's favorite, Warlord, Suicide Squad, and many, many more. But we knew him best, of course, as the editor of the original Who's Who series, taking over from Len Wein as of issue number 14. Bob not only had to organize the massive project that was Who's Who, dealing with dozens of different creators, but he also had to answer the, at times, persnickety, minutia-obsessed fan mail that Who's Who inspired, selections of which can be found on the inside covers of each issue.
So growing up, Rob and I, you know, we obsessed over Who's Who, you know, which turned into one of the, truthfully, biggest inspirations for starting the Firewater Podcast Network. So finally getting to sit down with one of the people who made it happen is a genuine thrill for us. Now, you're going to hear from Bob in just a minute, but first we need to take a second to thank our sponsors. And folks, this episode of Who's Who is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collectibles, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. What'd you bring, Rob?
Well, I knew you were going to pick the Who's Who Omnibus, so I decided to try something else. I went with the, because it's obvious. I went with Crisis on Infinite Earths Companion Deluxe Hardcover Volume 3. This collects a bunch of the comics that were the tie-ins to the Crisis, like Amethyst number 13, Blue Devils number 17 and 18, Wonder Woman 327 through 329. That's the final issue of Wonder Woman, by the way. Swamp Thing, Legion of Superheroes, Superman, DC Comics Presents, JLA, Omega Man, everybody's favorite, and includes many never-before-reprinted stories and new essays by Crisis Associate Editor Bob Greenberger. Huh, woo-hoo. Funny that. The cover is by, of course, George Perez. 536 pages of Crisis content. The normal price, $75, but in-stock trades price is only $43.50. You save 42% off, so check it out. Crisis and Infinite Earths Companion Deluxe Hardcover Volume 3.
These companions get my full endorsement. I've got all three of them. And at first I was like, why am I going to get this? Because like I've already got a lot of these issues. Now, it's magical the way it's put together. Bob's essays are great. It's just beautiful to just go seamlessly reading it through in order of how it was in Crisis. They're really fantastic. So yes, I did pick the Who's Who Omnibus. I spent a lot of time trying to be clever at first. Like, well, I'm going to pick a Star Trek book that Bob edited and all these different things. It finally came down to, why am I screwing around with this? Of course the pick is the Who's Who Omnibus, folks. If you don't own it already, it reprints the entire first 26-issue run. It reprints Update 87, all five issues, Update 88, four issues. It reprints all the stuff from the 89 annuals as well. This thing is, it doesn't have the page count here, but I know it's well over like 1,300 pages. It's incredibly huge. Gorgeous paper. It's beautifully redone. Cover art's, of course, by George Perez. It normally goes for $150, but in stock trades, the price is 65% off right now. 65% off. You can get it for $52.50. That is literally a steal. So, folks, for these and all your trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, we also need to take a second to thank you folks at home for your sponsorship through Patreon. Because running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon. And you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, consider supporting the Firewater Podcast Network. In a certain tier, you will get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. So our thanks to Christopher Lydon, Corey Drew, Damian Whiter, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Michael Atchison, Nathan Archer, Noah Tarnow,
Michael O'Brien, Chuck Coletta, Paul Kien, Steve Givens, Tom Perrin, Tom Panarese, David S. Gutierrez, and Gord Tolton. So again, just visit our Patreon, patreon.com/FW podcast.
All right, folks, you've heard enough from us. Now it's time to hand it over to Mr. Bob Greenberger.
Did you hear that?
Unfortunately.
Be careful, Batman!
According to Who's Who, the Ten-Eyed Man, a.k.a. Philip Reardon, was a soldier in the Special Forces.
I thought we had a deal, Batmite. I do the crime fighting. You go back to your home dimension.
He was wounded in battle and took a job back home as a security guard. One night, thieves knocked him out and planted a bomb. When Batman arrived to stop them, Reardon mistook him for one of the robbers and they fought. The bomb exploded, blinding Reardon. But a surgeon attached his optic nerves to his fingertips and Reardon became the Ten-Eyed Man!
Weird.
Beat it, kid.
True fans appreciate a nod to the more obscure villains from your rogues gallery.
So, Bob, how did you end up working for DC Comics and how did you land the Who's Who assignment?
In a lot of ways, this goes back to the summer of 1980. I had graduated from State University of New York at Binghamton that May, and my job at Starlog Press wasn't going to begin until September. So Paul Levitz, bless his heart, brought me on as summer help. So he stuck me and Andy Helfer in half of an office. Andy had been hired by Jeanette a month earlier to work on Wonder Woman's 40th. And I was hired to actually go into the library and help create a property catalog for their international market. So I was sitting there reading all the comic books, creating, you know, short pressy about characters like Hop Harrigan and, you know, a lot of the Golden Age characters. So I'm sitting in there reading all the stuff. And then slowly but surely, Joe Orlando dragooned Andy and me to working with him on the growing special projects department. So I got to know all the editors. I got to know a bunch of the creators. And then in September, when Andy was invited to stay on full time, I had gone to honor my deal at Starlog and was there where I created Comic Scene Magazine. Woo-hoo. So along the way, I was continuing to interview people and covered the news for DC. When Comic Scene was canceled, I had reached out to Dick and we had met at the San Diego Comic-Con in the summer of 1983. And I said, get me out of there because they're putting me on the car and wrestling magazines. And that really wasn't my bailiwick. Dick made lots of nice noises and said, nothing today, but, you know, we'll keep you in mind. Then in December, he reached out and invited me to come in to interview. As it turns out, I was Plan B. Plan A was if they could lure Denny from Marvel, make him a full-time editor. But at that point, Denny was not in a position to leave Marvel. So Dick took that salary slot. And with Marvin Len's blessing, hired me on as an assistant editor specifically for the Crisis in Who's Who. And I joined staff January 9th, 1984.
Wow. What a great gig. Oh, my God.
That's all I could think. I was like, that's like the dream gig for a comic book nerd.
So, you know, I show up and I said, all right, so where are we? And they said, yeah, we're not so sure yet. You know, Peter Sanderson had spent 1982 and 1983 in the library reading everything they had done and filled two very thick three-inch three-ring binders with notes on every comic ever, you know, produced by DC as the original notes for the Who's Who. Problem was, you know, you're still going to have to flip through hundreds of pages of notes. So, but from that, we were able to start creating a master character list. And Len had it very clear in his head what the guidelines had to be, which was minimum of three appearances, had to be a significant supporting player, either hero or villain. And we started building the list that way. And we knew that we had been approved for 24, 32-page issues, so we knew what our counts were. And then we started the design work. Neil Poston was the design director. So he helped us create some design templates for how the art and text would work together because we knew we wanted to go shorter than what the Marvel Handbook, which had launched by then, was doing. And we did three templates. We did, you know, the Goldilocks approach, small, medium, and large, and presented the three. We had written a dummy Aquaman entry, and we showed it to Jeanette Kahn, and Jeanette went for the smallest entry. We ignored her and went with the medium entry. And from there, we started figuring out how to space out all the books. Meantime, Neil is also designing what the pages are going to look like, the font and the yellow borders that resembled our wallpaper at 666 Fifth Avenue. With Todd Klein, the two of them came up with the logo. We came up with these 11x17 sheets, grids. So we were able to spec out, all right, a character like Aquaman needs this much space, we estimated, and we'd X off exactly where the text would go so the artist knew the size and shape of the art. And then we had to explain to them what we wanted, which was a full figure shot of the character where you could see all the costume details. We knew if you were masked, we needed an unmasked headshot. We needed to see the powers in use so that it was a visual encyclopedia along with the text.
Wow.
At which point, we had our master list. And, of course, you're in New York, and this is the 80s when everyone had to be in New York to deliver work for the most part. So everyone was coming in and hearing about the project, and we started taking wish lists. And from there, we started assigning work. And bit by bit, the project started to come together.
That's amazing. So, like, I had no idea about the sheets that you guys, like you said, the gridded where you crossed it all out. I had no idea. We just thought it was, like, you know, guesstimation and stuff like that.
Yeah, and there was one time, I'm forgetting which artist it was because it's been, you know, quite a number of years, but one misread it and tried to do the art where the text went. So from then on, we had to mark it with a big X in the on the grid going, text here.
Okay. And also, I thought the yellow wallpaper came after Who's Who. I didn't realize it came before.
No, the yellow wallpaper was there when DC moved to 666, I guess 80 or so.
So was it? Okay, so all right, this is blowing my mind because my understanding was always that the yellow dots were supposed to represent the printing process, and that's why DC came up with it. But you're saying that it was already there from whatever previous company was there?
Not the previous company. It was DC. It was their wallpaper. It was custom made for DC offices. It was the yellow wallpaper, and of course, everybody had yellow word balloon nameplates for their offices. So everything was, you know, very carefully coordinated. I suspect Neil Posner and Joe Orlando had a lot to do with that, but you'd have to check that with someone who was there back then, like Todd Klein or Paul.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, we've talked a lot about the editing and things like that, but I know you wrote a ton of the entries in the loose leaf edition. Well, and they didn't feature the credits, the writer credits on the first volume of Who's Who in the updates. Did you write many of those entries in the first couple volumes?
For the first 12 issues, absolutely. I was young and naive, and Len and Marv were convincing me that I would write the entries for my third or quarter of each issue, and I would let them invoice, and they would pay me out of their pocket, as freelance income. And I didn't realize at the time that meant they were going to get the royalties until somebody pulled me off in a quarter and said, you know, they're ripping you off.
Wow. Okay.
So after that, I think after the fourth or fifth issue, I started invoicing on my own. So, you know, it really was interesting because Len and Marv were busy editing the Who's Who, coordinating the art, brainstorming the crisis with me. And it was becoming real apparent that they were going to have less and less time to write. So Marv took all the Titans characters and one or two other exceptions. Len had a couple of favorite characters, and then it was up to people like, you know, Mike Barr did all the Outsiders, and Paul Evans did all the Legion, and then Peter Sanderson and I did most of the rest of the writing.
I'm going to assume, just going back a couple of minutes, I'm going to assume that the short version of the Aquaman entry that you showed to Jeanette just said he's the greatest hero in the DC universe, and that's all. That's...
Oh, you know, it was maybe, you know, 200 words. It was a little more than that.
I think it said he talked to fish, Rob, is basically what it said.
So, all right, fair enough. So, by the way, I went to the DC offices once when I was a kid, and I remember that yellow wallpaper. Did that hurt your eyes to walk down that bright yellow hallway all the time? That seemed to be really kind of eye gougy from my memory of it.
I hate to say it, but it's wallpaper. After a while, you stop noticing.
So, okay. So how did you end up taking over the editing from Len Wein at the 14th issue?
Okay. So basically what was going on in 1984 were a couple of things. One, Len and Marv were trying to do both Who's Who and The Crisis simultaneously, co-editing. And it was clear we weren't getting anywhere with The Crisis while Who's Who was coming up and running. And Dick recognized that something needed to change and decided to stick Len strictly on Who's Who because that was more to his editorial strengths. While Marv was going to work with me and George on The Crisis, I would be the conduit between the two to make sure everything was in alignment. Len was going through personal and professional issues at the time. So as we were moving through all of this, I guess, trying to remember this now, but it was maybe, it was Worldcon in Anaheim in 1984. So sometime after that, Len decided he was going to relocate to California and leave his staff job at DC, at which point that meant he was giving up his editorial assignments, which led to things like Barbara Kiesel finishing Watchmen and me taking over Who's Who and Denny coming in to take Batman and, you know, things like that. So I ended up taking over the Who's Who. Whatever issue was officially credited, the transition happened a lot earlier as Len was increasingly focused on gearing up to move, you know. So things happened.
Gotcha.
And I took over and brought in other people to do the writing and got the books out on time while working with Marv to make The Crisis, you know, this amazing project.
Well, you talked a little earlier about the way some of the characters were split up as far as who was writing chores. Were there any, though, that you specifically requested that you said, oh, I want to write the entry for that character? And that could be from any edition, by the way. That could be loose leaf, original, any of them.
Well, obviously, when we got to the loose leaf, I had been editing a number of the books, so I wanted to do all the Suicide Squad and Doom Patrol-related entries, things like that. But for the original run, we'd look at each issue's lineup, and once we had the Paul and Mike Barr assignments figured out, it was, you know, whoever felt like doing an entry. I don't recall glomming onto, you know, a handful of characters from a specific title or anything. It was, you know, just a sheer pleasure to, you know, show the length and breadth and stuff. I mentioned Top Harrigan earlier from the property catalog in 1980. So when we got to his character, you know, I did grab that one because it was just fun.
So with Marv, I got to ask, because I've always noticed the outsider entries, at least in the first wave of Who's Who, the text is always, there's not a lot there. It's very concise. Now it's well put together. It's like a great pitch, but there's not a lot there. Did you ever get on Marv's case? I'm sorry.
Well, of the outsiders, it's Mike Barr. And in right. Mike's case, he was just, you know, very, very succinct.
Okay. I just didn't know as editor, you're like, come on, Mike, I need some more than that. There's only so much Jim Aparo
really,
can draw.
Because I knew it'd get great Jim Aparo work to finish it out. It was fine.
There you go. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So, okay. I apologize for this question, Bob, but we were trying not to get too specific because as we know, as you talked about, this is a long time ago and you know, you weren't committing this stuff to memory like a couple of nerds might be when they're 10. when you were, you know, obviously you came along as editor of the book as it was already rolling. But were there any characters that you were like, I really want in here and just the, you know, Dick Giordano, whoever was like, no, they're not going. Did you have any personal favorites that you were really rooting for?
Dick never looked at the lineup. He totally trusted us and our judgment. And, you know, it didn't take long to convince Dick I knew what I was doing and knew the character. So he trusted the three of us, and that was fine. As far as characters, you know, honestly, it did start to grow a little like Topsy. And as a result, we went to 26 issues with everyone's blessing because it had been selling and it was commercially viable. So no one minded going to more issues. So that meant I got to fit in what we needed as things developed. So that gave me a little breathing room. I'm, you know, since this question came up preparing for this, I honestly do not remember being denied any character I felt belonged in the book.
Wow.
Okay.
Now, I will say, you know, we asked artists for wish lists, and Bill Ray, who had been inking a lot of stuff for us at the time, came in and asked for Don Caballero. Now, Don Caballero had a short run Western feature in the 50s.
Right.
And he did not make our cut. as we were getting to the D's, I guess he didn't fit. And then Len saw him on the wish list and said, yeah, let's put him in. So we made room for Don Caballero. Early on, we did do the half pages. And we, after a while, we cut those out because they were really tough to manage and people didn't like drawing for half rate. So that, you know, that was an evolutionary change.
And that Don Caballero listing is great. I can picture it really in my head as you said it. And so I could imagine that if someone is asking for a character that specific, like they're going to really sink their teeth into it because when else is Bill Ray going to get to draw Don Caballero?
Sure. And once people saw the book, it was a lot easier to say, hey, we want to do an entry for it. I mean, you know, some of the veteran artists like Gil Kane saw it as easy money because they, you know, Gil was doing all these covers. So to him, it was like doing a cover with a little more art direction. So you know, he was a joy to work with on that stuff.
So with talking about these ones that you wrote for any of the Who series or ones that you edit for that matter, is there any entries that were produced, whether you wrote or edited or whatever, that really stand out in your mind that you're really proud of or you thought just really came together?
Good question. I think, you know, the big guns were the toughest to condense and, you know, keeping Batman and Superman, Wonder Woman, you know, to the couple of pages was a real challenge and became almost art, you know, satisfying that we got it done with nice art to go with it. Some of the fun stuff came together really nicely, like the Batmite page, the Yes Pitalik page. But beyond that, you know, so many of them were just solid workmanlike efforts that got the job done. And frankly, with the production schedule we were under to get 32 pages of Who's Who plus the Crisis every month, you know, it really just became process.
Yeah,
not art.
Totally understand. At some point, it's you got to get the job done, right?
Yeah.
So how intimidating for you was it writing Neil Gaiman's Sandman entry?
Well, you know, Neil and I knew each other because when he was starting to write for DC, one of the first projects he had done was Books of Magic. And as Karen Berger asked me to consult on it for the continuity stuff, so I got to talk to Neil about a lot of the material that went in there. And so, you know, we formed a good working relationship. So when it came time to do something like the Sandman entry, to me, it was like a real pleasure, a real, you know, an honor to be, you know, trusted to take, you know, at the time, one of DC's best-selling characters and most critically acclaimed in doing that page. At the time, it also wasn't the Sandman like it is today.
True. That's true. Yeah. So, all right. Time for confession time. Who wrote the death entry? It's very controversial. It's the one where you just flip it over and there's absolutely nothing in it. It's just written that says, you'll find out when you meet her or something like that. It's very controversial amongst the fans. Even to this day, we found out that it's still very controversial among the fans.
Honestly, my recollection is that was conceived by Michael Urey in consultation, probably with Karen Berger.
Okay, interesting. All right,
I'm sure Neil had a thumbs up on it or not, but I wasn't involved in that particular page other than enjoying the art.
It's amazing that, you know, 30 years later, fanboys still get worked up about whether they should have been more complete or not. I think it's brilliant. So.
Well, you know, by the loose leaf edition, you got to be a little more creative and you got to be a little truer to the characters as opposed to the function of the encyclopedia. Because the original run in the 80s was specifically designed to be both an encyclopedia for the fans as well as the celebration of our company's 50th anniversary, which is why non-continuity characters like the Camelot 3000 and Watchmen characters made it into the book.
So about the encyclopedic nature of that, I've always heard a story that there was some publishing reasons for putting all the characters' names on the cover and picking out some of the more obscure ones inside because it renewed the copyright on certain characters. Is there any truth to that?
Not on Who's Who. What would happen is the legal department every couple of months would issue a list of titles that we were in danger of losing our claim to for trademark purposes. And we were asked, can we put them on the cover some way, shape or form? It meant doing a reprint issue or, you know, working into the cover copy, using the logo on the cover, you know, something like Strange Adventures and Mystery in Space. That's certainly how I came up with Suicide Squad because that was on the list one month. And I said, oh, I like that. I got to do something with this title.
Wow.
But that no, worked out, it didn't did it? Not apply to Who's Who because it had to be the logo for trademark.
Interesting. I did not know that. Okay. Huh. Now, as far as artists and assignments go, we've talked about some had, like, you know, their established characters they were responsible for, or there was wish lists and things like that. When you find yourself with a character that didn't have a writer or an artist that was, you know, well-known, or specifically artists, I should say, now, an artist that's not well-known for it, and it's not anybody's wish list, how would you help dole that out? Like, what would guide you on that? And then were there any artists that you helped recruit over to DC to do some of these?
There were a couple of factors that went into this. One, Len said from the outset, we must introduce at least one new artist in every issue just to keep things fresh and make it interesting. So that was one guideline. Two, we would see who had drawn that character sometime in the last couple of years that we might be able to tap. Mm-hmm. Three, it was whatever warm body was in the office if we were really pressed.
All right.
You know, so there was that. As far as recruiting went, absolutely. I mean, you know, over at 13th Dimension, I had done a list of the artists that we wanted to get and didn't get, and some of the mm-hmm. artists that I was really proud of getting. And to me, because I was paying attention to what was coming from the independent publishers and the smaller presses, there were some artists whose stuff I really, really liked and wanted to recruit. So at the conventions, I went shopping for artists. And people went, you know, looking for back issues. I went for artists, which is how I struck up a conversation with Jaime Hernandez and was able to get him through Legion characters because he told me he loved the Legion.
Hmm.
That was literally what I saw in my mind, Bob, was the listing he did for the Phantom Girl, which is brilliant.
And he also did the Shrinking Violet. You know, so that was serendipity. I really love Dave Stevens stuff, so I was able to talk to him. And in Dave's case, he was willing to do it, but worked with production and sent us negatives because he didn't want to trust the original art in the mail or the original art in anyone else's hands.
Hmm. Oh, wow.
I didn't understand
so
that.
So he sent negatives of the material. And of course, he got, you know, the hot women, which was just fine by me.
Yes, it was. I think every red-blooded 13-year-old boy remembers Catwoman and Dolphin from Who's Who.
Uh-huh.
Phantom Lady.
You know, so people like that, you know, Michael T. Gillard, you know, I really liked his Mr. Monster stuff, so getting him to do, like, you know, Midnight was great.
That's a great entry.
Thank you. The fun of it was, you know, who could I get? Now, obviously, you know, you wanted to get people from Marvel, you know, sort of, you know, tweaking the competition a little bit because, you know, they had their set artists on the handbook for their house style. We were a lot more creative and diverse. So, you know, like, you know, the one I really, really wanted and almost got was Sal Buscema. I knew I wasn't going to get John. I knew I wasn't going to get John Romita. So I was working, you know, if I could get Sal, I was going to be happy. And then he backed out at the last minute.
Oh.
Did you have a character in mind for him?
He was going to do Starman, the Golden Age.
Now you just said you knew you weren't going to get John Buscema. Now, how did you know that? Was he just like, he was not interested in working for DC in any way, shape, or form?
Well, you know, John Romita was, I believe, still on staff at the time, so I knew I couldn't get in touch a staff employee, and I'm pretty certain Buscema, Big John, was on contract.
Gotcha, okay.
And Marvel was not going to let a guy out of contract to do work for the competition.
Gotcha, okay. Yeah, I could see that. I love the, you got John Bolton to do Shining Knight. Yep. I remember that one was amazing because, again, that was an artist that you never saw in the pages of DC Comics. So that, for that
no,
one
but it was
amazing.
Because of his Epic series. Blanking on the name at the moment, but it was one set with knights and all. And I said, that's our guy.
Yeah, he loves all that. He loves all that kind of stuff. That's amazing.
And it was great because, you know, it was a page in and out, and he was flattered to be invited because he hadn't done anything else for DC. So, you know, sometimes you get people, they were thrilled.
Yeah.
Then you get a guy like Mick McMahon who's like, yeah, I'm happy doing my stuff for Marvel. Why should I bother for DC? He was always skeptical about working for us for some reason.
So, okay, no names, Bob, but was there ever was there ever any Who's Who art that got submitted that you couldn't use? Like, I mean, not just somebody just didn't do it right or it didn't look right?
Or miss a deadline. Yeah.
Okay, I was known as Mr. Schedule. Deadline was never an issue. We always worked far enough in advance that if an artist crapped out, there was time to get somebody else. Mm-hmm. I do not recall specific instances where we needed that somebody else. And if somebody penciled something and it wasn't quite right, and we would get an inker to fix it, or I'd get Dick to fix it, because it's great having an artist in the house. I cannot, to this day, remember anyone we had to reject summarily and replace them with somebody else. So we were very fortunate in that regard. But that does lead me to a story where Kurt Swan was given the Superman entry, and we had already lined up John Byrne to ink it because that was going to be the handoff, visual handoff. And the page comes in, and I had to call Kurt and go, Kurt, it's supposed to be two pages, not one.
Oh.
And totally misread that. And I'm really sorry. I'll redo it. And of course, he redid it for two pages. And then let me keep the one page he didn't do. So it is framed and hanging over my desk at the moment. So I've got Kurt Swan, Jor-El and Lara and Mom, Pa, Kent and Lois and everything in one, two-thirds of a page with a handwritten note from him apologizing for screwing it up.
Wow. Well, along those lines, and I'm trying to find it here, and I'm going off the top of my head, which it never works out, but there's a Who's Who cover we've seen, and I'm trying to remember if it's Ordway or Ernie Colone that didn't get used. I want to say it was a Red Tornado cover. Oh, geez. Again, this is what happens when you try and remember off the top of your head. any recollections? Does that ring any bells? I'll keep looking it up, but does that ring any bells?
Not a specific story behind that. Obviously, you know, George wanted to do the wraparound covers for all 24 so he could draw every character DC ever published on the off chance he couldn't fit them in Crisis, especially characters that weren't going to be in the Crisis because they were outside of the continuity, like Camelot. But clearly, the Crisis became this all-consuming event. So he had to bow out. And at that point, Paris Cullins was the next likely candidate because he was in the office all the time. We could work with him on the design and get him all the reference he needed. And Paris being Paris was struggling to, you know, make that work on a regular enough basis while doing Blue Devil. So we turned to other people, and that was when Ernie started doing more work for us. And, you know, then it became a matter of who can I get?
Mm.
You know, that became a bigger issue than who can I assign a page to because of the complexity of trying to do that wraparound cover.
So you mentioned getting the art at the pencil stage and then shipping it off to the inker. So, I mean, this seems like maybe a dumb question, but the Who's Who entries were treated kind of the way you would any other book, and that you were seeing it at that stage. And that way you could have a chance to say, these pencils need a little bit of a fixing, that kind of thing. It wasn't, I mean, obviously some artists like Jim Aparo inked their own work. So you're seeing it when it's a finished piece, but you were getting all the entries in pencil form before you shipped them off.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at guys like Carmine Infantino and Gil Kane, not Gil Kane, I'm sorry, Carmine and Kurt and, you know, some of the others who were just pencilers for us at that point. So they would, you know, either send it in with a cover or send it in with their other job that they were doing for the company. And so, yeah, I'd get the zero, the pencil page. I would photocopy it and then send it off to the inker with any notes for changes that were required. So, yeah, we had to treat it like any story page.
So, okay, Bob, there's a topic here that we're dancing around, and it's a very sensitive topic. Who's Who fans, and I got to bring it up because here's your chance. No Sugar and Spike, Bob. Really?
Yeah,
they had 98 issues of their own series. What does it take to get a listing at Who's Who? 98 issues, Bob.
Sugar and Spike, as a celebration of DC's history, should have been there. No question about it. Sheldon had done the Red Tornado entry for us, so there was no reason not to have him do Sugar and Spike. But by the time we were getting to the S's, Crisis was over, and the editorial focus started shift more to presenting the characters post-Crisis. And that is a debatable point. Should we have stuck to the original editorial guidelines, and therefore Sugar and Spike should have been in there? Or should we have kept it contemporary for the readers so they're not confused? You know, we could keep debating that to the, you know, until 1 a.m. today, but it is what it is. I regret not getting that page done by Sheldon. That would have been a beautiful thing. We all have our regrets.
I would just like to say that, Bob, you're an incredibly good sport for putting up with that nonsense for that long. I fully expected a just deal with a fanboy kind of answer.
I think it's a reasonable. I think it's a reasonable, reasonable thing to bring up. So
absolutely, there's no question about it. I mean, you know, arguably, if we were celebrating the company's full range of publishing, we probably should have done more of the funny animal characters, but we didn't.
Right. I mean, I understood why you didn't do, you know, Binky and all that.
Right,
I mean,
Binky, yeah.
That I understood. But I just felt like Sugar and Spike were just such – and they even appear in The Crisis, for Pete's sakes.
Well, you know, that's a case where I should have done something, gotten Stan Goldberg to draw a page for us.
Okay.
And that would have been fine because he is – miss him. Stan was a versatile guy. You know, he could do the realistic style like you saw in Millie before it went to the Archie look. Mm-hmm. He was very adaptable.
Now, before we move on, I did find what I was looking for earlier, so I'm not crazy.
Okay.
So it is Who's Who, number 19. The cover that was published, it is the Red Tornado issue. The cover that was published was by Ernie Colone. However, in the Modern Masters series that Two Morrows put together, in the Jerry Ordway edition, there is an unpublished Who's Who cover by Jerry Ordway and Mike Macklin for that issue. And I didn't know if you happened to be aware of this other unpublished cover or the history or story behind
obviously,
it.
Yes, I would have been aware of it because by the time you get up to the Red Tornado, it would have been my editorial duties. And I would have to talk to Jerry and refresh my memory because I honestly don't recall what happened.
Okay. Right. Understood. I'll send you a link afterwards just so you can see the cover because it's stunning.
Yes, it is. And it's a gorgeous piece. So
yeah, I'm looking at my bookshelf now. I don't see my Jerry Ordway volume. So maybe I don't have that one. My bad.
So speaking of angry fanboys, the letters pages of Who's Who. Now, one thing that Shag and I have been tracking over the course of all the years we've been doing the Who's Who show is because we talk about the letters pages.
Yeah.
And the letters pages in the original Who's Who are, of course, very detail specific. They're, you know, really obsessed with the minutiae. But of course they are because Who's Who invites that kind of, I mean, that's the point of Who's Who. It invites that kind of scrutiny. That said, by the time you got to the loose leaf letters pages, the letters kind of get angrier. And to me, it's like early Twitter, you know, where it's like, you really have these fans that are like, really kind of like, you know, there was one entry that like was miscolored, like instead of it being, you know, red for villain, it was colored green. And someone's just like, I demand a new copy. Like, they're really mad. And I wonder, as editor, what was it like kind of dealing with that sort of incipient tone of like, you know, just the sort of like, Who's Who more than other books seem to really inspire a kind of possessive, slightly kind of negative view of some of the fans, right? You were on the front lines of that stuff.
You know, the thing of it is, you promise people an encyclopedia and you want to make sure the facts are accurate. And to the best of our abilities, that's exactly what we did. I don't think you would have found better people to do the research and writing than people like myself and Peter Sanderson. But human error, the production schedules, oversights or interpretation. But my opinion about letter columns, as anyone who knew my editorial runs, know that I was perfectly open to being called on my mistakes, especially in something like Star Trek, where sometimes we made, you know, some goofs. I thought that because this was, you know, pre-internet, so that was the only way we could have a dialogue, and it's the only place where people can vent and express their frustration if we got something wrong. And I was totally open to that. I was not, you know, using the letter columns as just rah-rah space. So, you know, I respected their opinions. I wouldn't have run their letters otherwise. As far as the inside front and back covers, it was Len who came up with the idea for the pronunciation guide. But I did the letters and I did the, you know, where you can find the characters next back cover stuff.
I have had that pronunciation guide used against me by listeners so many times because I'm terrible at pronouncing things. And so the minute I get something wrong, someone sends me a screenshot of the Who's Who pronunciation guide, especially Despero, and say, look, kid, get it right. So they're still pedantic and frustrated.
Speaking
yeah,
of
yeah, well, you know, every now and then Len and I would go to Julie Schwartz and we go, so how do you say that one again? Especially something like an alien or Mizzius Pitalik.
Right. So got a question here. As a writer and an editor, you know, the different formats of Who's Who, as we've been talking about, like the loose leaf, the original, and even some of the annuals and stuff, it gave you a lot of different opportunities. So what did you feel, either from a creative or production difference, which one was most enjoyable to work on creatively from the various versions?
Well, you know, when we got to the loose leaf and then the Who's Who pages that ran in various annuals and later secret files, from my standpoint, they were writing assignments that I was happy to do. They gave me a chance to keep my hand in about, you know, writing about, you know, some favorite characters or helping out the editor. You know, he was in a jam. And it was also trying to service the characters for the needs of, you know, whatever the project was. You know, the Who's Who loose leaf was supposed to be a fresh start, whereas the annual Who's Who pages were, you know, supposed to be like a guide for the regular reader for all the Batman books. Mm-hmm. You know, so they had different purposes. The original Who's Who run as a writer and then later as the editor, you know, they're, and I, this is going to sound maybe pretentious, but, you know, there was a sacred trust in doing that original run because this was going to be the first Bible we were offering the readers. And we had to make sure the gospel was right. So we did everything humanly possible to respect the 50-year history, respect the characters, and respect the readers by giving them the best we possibly could.
I'm really glad to hear that on the other side, because as a reader, I feel the same way. I mean, and I was always afraid I was biased because that was my first introduction to a lot of this stuff. But for me, the first Who's Who just does hold a special, I don't know, canonical? That's probably not the right word.
Yeah. But when we finished the 26 issues, we had put copies aside and Dick found the money in the budget. We bound 2-volume sets for every editorial office.
Oh, wow.
And everyone, and we made, I think copies went to licensing and other departments. So that became the company Bible for quite a number of years.
Mm. Well, I'm glad it was respected by other folks besides just us folks reading it, because it's well worth celebrating. And the omnibus nowadays, I mean, just wonderful. So
the omnibus, you know, when I saw the first printed copy and was like, my gosh, first of all, really nice paper, really nice reproduction, no flexographic. and, you know, just to flip through it, it was like, wow. And I'm really glad they included the front and back inside cover material because that really made it complete.
Mm. So you brought up Star Trek. So let's go down that road for just a second, because not only did you, you know, obviously have a very long association with Star Trek, you also served as the editor in the Who's Who in the Star Trek volume. So do you have any particular memories of working on that volume, or did you have any any personal objectives as a Trek fan for it?
This was before the Okudas did the Star Trek Encyclopedia, mm-hmm. or the chronology, and there really wasn't anything resembling a character guide since the original concordance that had come out in the early to mid 70s. So I saw this as an opportunity to provide readers. It was, you know, Star Trek's 20th anniversary, so it was a chance to do some celebrating. And we were able to work with Paramount. We showed them what we had done with the superhero Who's Who. And they said, oh, this looks like a good, you know, brand extension. So, you know, they gave us the blessing. And fortunately, at that point, Alan Ashman had been the company librarian, and he's, you know, had written all this other Star Trek stuff back in the 70s. So I knew I had the right guy to do it all, do all the writing while I did the editing. So that was a chance for me to celebrate Star Trek, to provide something to the readers with the same sort of canonical need that we needed for the original DC Who's Who. My biggest regret was I needed a wider variety of artists than I could get, but getting the people willing to do work on likenesses and dealing with the licensing department's needs became a challenge. So there were a bunch of Tyros I wound up using a lot on, which made it less visually interesting than I had hoped. That said, I did get Walt Simonson and John Byrne, you know, so it wasn't totally Tyro time.
I was going to ask you about that because you got some real heavy hitters for that. I mean, how are you, as you mentioned, Simonson, John Byrne, Howard Chaykin doing the covers? Like, I assume they were all, you know, professed Trekkers and that you knew that about them.
Howard was a professional, and anytime I could offer him a painted cover assignment, he always grabbed it because he liked doing the paintings and he didn't mind doing the likenesses. And he brought a really nice design sense, which is why I had him do the movie adaptation covers, which led to the Who's Who assignments. Walt was enough of a fan that I was able to get him to do the Romulan page. And then Walt, who never, or very rarely, gives away artwork, gave me the page. So that was really sweet.
Oh, wow.
And John, as we now know, is such a major Star Trek fan. He was asking for pages, which was just fine by me.
Right. I mean, John Byrne drawing in the 80s. Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to turn that down. Sure. Right.
Exactly.
Wow.
So, you know, so that was two 48 page volumes that turned out pretty nicely that impressed the people at Pocketbooks. So at one point, when they were doing their CD-ROMs, I actually wrote a whole bunch of Who's Who style entries for them for a project that never went anywhere. So they, you know, that became inspirational to other people, which was kind of nice.
That's really cool. Jeez. So, you know what I mean? As we've talked about, Who's Who was designed as the ultimate continuity reference guide. And aside of being a celebration of where DC was at 50, but I mean, over the decades, you know, DC continuities have come and gone. Yet people are still reading and discussing the old Who's Who's. And as we just talked about, they're being reprinted in these absurdly deluxe, you know, hardcovers. I mean, do you have any idea of like why people are still so attached to them? Why they seem to hold up, even though the reason they were created was to establish continuity, is null and void at this point?
You always remember your first. And in this case, there was nothing like it from DC previous. And there was quite a number of years before there was anything like it again. So I think it was the right project to celebrate the company. It had the right diversity of being inclusive of so many artists who over the years immediately following the Who's Who, we lost. You know, people got sick and died or retired. And so we were getting people either just past their peak or at their peak. It was visually diverse. It was inclusive. And there was just nothing else like it at the time. And I think that's what still resonates. It also captures the essence of the characters as a certain generation or two of readers remember them and want to remember them. You know, Dan DiDio always said that after the New 52 didn't work and they went with Rebirth, it was like, these are the essences of the characters that everyone remembers. And that goes back to the Who's Who versions.
And, you know, Who's Who really did do a great job of capturing. You've referenced Marvel Handbook a couple times. Like, for me, the Marvel Handbook always read as this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. Whereas Who's Who was always about what's the spirit of the character.
Well, you know, Marvel had a different approach. Under Mark Gruenwald, he really wanted to quantify, you know, who could bench press 1,000 pounds and who could bench press 5,000 pounds and that sort of thing. Len never wanted to handcuff the writers that way. So that was a guideline from the outset. Marvel was definitely much more into explaining all this stuff, really in very technical terms that met Mark's needs, and Shooter signed off on it and the fans bought it and it worked for them. And having that consistent look to their art gave them a style guide when, you know, DC had its own style guides previous to Who's Who, so we didn't have to fulfill that function. You know, so the two books are similar, but they had different goals.
Well, you mentioned DiDio, and I want to touch on that, because in your Who's Who Omnibus introduction, it says that you were contracted to write a new Who's Who in the year 2009. It was going to be an 18-issue series at 48 pages per issue. The first thing I got to say to that is, what? Oh, my gosh. The second thing I got to ask is, what can you tell us about this unpublished project?
You know, so Dan calls me out of the blue one day, and he says, hey, you want to talk? And we were talking on the phone, and he was telling me he'd like to do a brand new Who's Who from the you know, where we were in 2009. You know, this is way before New 52 or anything like that. And he really was looking for something to help the readers figure out these characters as they existed at that time. And he told me it was going to be 18, 48-page issues, and he wanted me to be the writer. And he said, we're not sure who's going to edit this yet, but we want you to get started. We trust you that you know what you're doing, and we'll, you know, you write some entries. We'll share it around the editorial. You know, we'll get you some feedback. So Dan was titularly the editor at the beginning, but he was going to hand it off to somebody. So the first thing was we needed a list of who these characters were going to be and, you know, who's going to be in which issue. At that point, DC came to me and said, Justin Gray had written these 500-word character entries that were written for some other project. And I was asked, is there anything we could do with these to, you know, monetize them in some way rather than just having them sit on a shelf? And I looked at them and I said, they don't really fit what Dan is envisioning for this. So we couldn't use them. So I was starting from scratch. And this is in the wake of my having done the Batman Encyclopedia and working with Marty Pascal on the Superman Encyclopedia. You know, so I had the comics at my fingertips, so I had a better feel for what was going on at that moment. And I started writing. And every month I'd write my, you know, entries. I was the one figuring out which characters should be in which issue because no one was telling me otherwise, figuring we could always adjust later. And as I'm finishing the fifth issue, Dan is talking about it in one of his Meanwhile columns or whatever it was called. And the next thing you know, boom. You know, the changes to management and the project was put on the shelf. Mm-hmm. In fact, that going on the shelf and costing me what I thought was going to be at least another year's worth of pretty nice freelance income led to me becoming a teacher because all of a sudden everything had dried up because that was also the same time the iPad was introduced and digital publishing became a thing and nobody was approving anything until they could figure out how to monetize digital publishing.
Oh.
So it was like this major upheaval in my life. Beyond just the who's who.
Wow.
So I've got 5 issues worth of written stuff. Now, DC paid for it. They own it. But I've got my copy somewhere on a file.
We'll send you our address, Bob. You can just send them to us whenever you want.
So well, that's amazing that that was in development. I mean, I know DK has gone on to do an encyclopedia or edition on pretty much everything and everything. Under
yeah, I was one of the 4 writers of the first version of that. And with each passing volume, less and less of my stuff has survived. And I was never invited back to any of the updates, mostly because I got into an argument with DK over some of the content and some of the things they wanted. And I was like, my biggest problem is I'm always fighting for the integrity of the material and they're always fighting for the integrity of the commercial plan.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So I was never invited back to DK, which is a shame because a bunch of their stuff is beautiful. And I wish I, you know, was part of them and writing some of those projects.
So you mentioned teaching. I got to assume that's very rewarding with kids. And because, I mean, that's kind of who you were working for a lot of years in a lot of sense with comics. And now you're get to be face to face with them. So in addition to teaching, like what other projects are you working on right now?
Well, through, you know, 10 months of the year, it's pretty much just teaching with small stuff on the side because I can barely, you know, find the free time when I'm not grading and planning after school hours to, you know, do anything major. So as I just was blogging earlier this week about, I've got a whole bunch of short stories that I wrote in the last year and a half or so that have yet to see print. We'll see print in 2022. I've got a novella for one of these loot crate box programs on cryptids. But I'm not allowed to mention which cryptid I wrote about.
Okay.
And there's somebody else who had an idea for a book project, sold it to a publisher, but he's not, you know, he's a great idea guy and he can write to a degree, but he really needed somebody to come in and take his ideas and really run with it. And the publisher I had done a book for, Athon Books, asked me if I would work with this guy. And I wrote the novel last summer and I'm finally going to see the creators revisions to my manuscript probably in another week or so and get his notes on the outline for book two. And then in theory, either Christmas break or spring break, I'll start writing book two for him because it's supposed to be a trilogy. Still doing stuff with Crazy Eight Press, which is our loose conglomerate of imprint material where, you know, Rob's Hey Kid Comics originally debuted.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still doing stuff there. So I've done my Thrilling Adventure Yarns tribute to the pulp magazines. I've done two volumes of that and continuing to write for some of the other anthologies at a C8. So there's always something going on. And just not a lot of comic stuff at the moment.
Well, all that sounds very interesting. And where can they, when those books become available, where could people find them? What would be the best way to hunt them down?
I'm always blogging about this stuff. So anyone who wants to follow me on Twitter at Bob Greenberger or at my website, bobgreenberger.com, you know, they'll find the stuff. I've got all my books listed there. I'm trying to finish archiving and cataloging all my articles from Starlog and Fangoria and Comic Scene so that I have a complete bibliography online somewhere because I'm a completist.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Jake. Speaking of your blog, Bob, I we were supposed to end it here, but I have one more question. I just thought of it. I need to ask you because we're good. I don't want to pass up this opportunity. You did a blog post recently about the custom Who's Who listings by our dear departed pal, Zoom Yukinori.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, how did you come across these things? And when you did you have the reaction of like, did I forget that we did this? Because like, they are so well done that they fool a lot of people.
As I said in the blog post, I had no idea any of this was going on. Because of teaching and writing and trying to be a good husband and spend time with my wife, I don't have time for listening to a lot of blog podcasts. And as a result, I've not kept up with Fire and Water and missed all of the stuff he had done for you guys. So Shag reached out to me and said the family would like to get me a copy of this thing that I knew nothing about. And so Shag saw to it, I got a copy from the family. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, it came in a plastic bag and I've got it next to my two bound volumes of Who's Who because it belongs right there with them. It was such an amazing work of love.
You know, before that was actually physically printed a comic, I took the Superman of Earth One entry and the Wonder Woman of Earth One, because you know those were that Zoom did, and I went to the copier and got it printed to the right size, folded them and slipped them into the issue where they should be. I didn't mess with the staples, but they're just resting right inside the issue.
Sure.
That's where they belong. So in fact, you haven't even seen this yet, Bob, but Zoom's son has continued on the tradition and has just put together a Who's Who entry for Ace the Bat-Hound, which is glorious.
That's appropriate.
Yep.
My favorite moment regarding any of those listings by Zoom is when they make their way onto the internet somehow and somebody sees one and they don't know the context. And I've seen people go, wait a minute, has my copy of the S issue of Who's Who been missing a page all these years? Where's this? Like, they lose their minds because it looks so perfect. And I have to say, I mean, we were not going to speak for Zoom's family or Isamu or anyone else, but to me, you doing a blog post on Zoom's listings, I felt like it all came full circle. You know, like, the guy who name I think of the most when I think of Who's Who is talking about Zoom's listings. It's all just perfect.
Yeah, I wanted to acknowledge his passing and this labor of love that he had been doing for years, express my own ignorance and appreciation for everything he had done. You know, and looking at his inside cover and all of his text, I appreciate the fact that he even listed our proofreader, Brenda Pope, who I swear would get migraines reading this stuff.
She is the unsung hero about who we talk about her on a lot of the
episodes. Oh, yeah, we mentioned Brenda every episode. Sure. Hero. Yep.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that DC's had some really interesting proofreaders through the years, going all the way back to Gerda Gattell, who DC picked up during one of Marvel's rounds of layoffs in the 50s, I guess. But the company's had, you know, some very interesting people doing that job. Brenda being an unsung hero, but, you know, her predecessor was Robert Lauren Fleming, who went on to be a writer. So,
right. Well, Bob, this has been an absolute blast. Thank you so much for making the time to do this. It really, as we've been doing the show for 10 years now, it's really wonderful to finally get a chance to speak with someone behind the scenes, an architect who really helped put all this together. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is this was Len and Marv's project. They created it. They brought me in. They gave me a home when I really was looking for one. I've become the face of Who's Who because it's, you know, they have a body of work that they are more closely associated with. This is sort of was my big introduction to fandom. But Who's Who has given me all these opportunities. If I hadn't done Who's Who, it wouldn't have led to my writing things like the Loose Leaf edition or the annuals, which then led to me doing the Batman Encyclopedia or the DC Encyclopedia for DK, which most recently led to me doing this Dreadstar Handbook for Ominous Press. So it was going back to my Who's Who roots doing that. It was like, you know, it's like it is part of my legacy, which was never the intended. It just happened. And it's kind of gratifying, kind of interesting. But I'm glad we had a chance to talk about this.
Well, if I can ask one more favor, Bob, could you help us sign off the show the way we do every episode by saying the words, who's next? All right, one, two, three.
Who's next?
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Irelia, Woolly Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Aw, man. We forgot Slipknot.